listening to an extra shot episode on the Project Zion podcast, a shorter episode that lets you get your Project Zion fix in between our full-length episodes. It might be shorter time-wise, but hopefully not in content. So regardless of the temperature at which you prefer your caffeine, sit back and enjoy this extra shot.
Welcome to Project Zion Podcast. I'm Karen Peter, and this is Cup of Joe, where we discuss matters related to restoration history, or as I sometimes say, all things church history. Our guest today is the always informative Locke Mackay, who serves as both a member of the Council of Twelve and as the Director of Historic Sites for Community of Christ. So, welcome back, Locke.
Joy to be with you.
Looking forward to our conversation today, Locke, because we are talking about what's called the First Vision, capitalized, and it's what Restoration traditions would call the experience Joseph Smith Jr. had when, as a young boy, he went into the grove of trees to pray. So first, Locke, why is this vision, this experience, important in the life of the church? In other words, who is it that cares about a young boy's experience going into the woods and encountering the divine? I mean, why is this important?
Well, there are probably some longtime heritage members of Community of Christ who care deeply, but in my experience, it comes up most often at historic sites in response to our orientation videos that kind of lay out the story of the church. And our visitors very often have questions or concerns about the way we present the first vision, as it is often known.
Okay, so I know how I learned the story as a kid growing up in the RLDS church. In fact, it was the story that we all learned when I was a kid. Joseph Smith Jr. was a boy and he didn't know what church to join, so he went out into the woods and he prayed, and God told him that all the other churches were wrong and he was supposed to start his own church, and so that's what he did, and that's why we are the one and only true church. No commas, no breaths. That is the story. So I'm assuming that's not the story in your orientation videos that concerns people. So how do the materials at the Community of Christ Historic Sites tell the story?
So you're correct. That's not the version we tell, but I also think it's fascinating that that was the version you learned. I keep running into, depending on when and where, how very different experiences have been in Community of Christ. So my experience growing up in Eastern Jackson County, Missouri, the 1970s, 80s, not my experience. Fascinating. But the versions at historic sites, the Nauvoo video, which is the older of the two I'll be talking about, talks about Joseph having an experience with the divine. And people really do not like that language. And they also really want to see two personages. And we just don't specify. We just an experience with the divine.
We're going to cover both of those things here. I'm trying to decide which to tackle first in this. So you mentioned an experience with the divine, that people are uncomfortable with that language. Some people will be surprised by that. But I remember the phrase, listen to the voice, in Inspired Counsel in the 90s, early 2000s. And that freaked people out at World Conference. So I understand that people get uncomfortable with nomenclature that isn't traditional. I'm assuming that's the problem.
I think that's the problem. That's part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is there's not two personages identified. How come you're not showing me two people who look just like each other?
God and Jesus.
Mm-hmm. God and Jesus, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, so why? Why are there not two personages? How is the story presented that causes these concerns?
So there are not two personages because there are multiple accounts left by Joseph, and some feature one personage and some feature two personages. And so trying to make room for multiple accounts, we went with Experience with the Divine. But more recently, we were working on a Kirtland video for the new Kirtland Temple Visitor Center. So I say more recently, but it was 2005 and 6 when we were working on it. It was kind of a new opportunity to think about how to present the first vision. And we decided, because typically historians think the earlier the telling of the story, the more likely it is to be accurate. So we decided to go with the earliest account. So it's 1832. It's the only one in Joseph's hand. And it's one personage, and from the verbiage, it is either, it seems to be Jesus, although Joseph is still Trinitarian at that point in time. So, but I still think it's Jesus that he experiences in the grove. And we get less negative feedback about that version, but still probably some questions, why not two personages?
So how did the version of the two personages become the, and I'm making the air quotes in my Zoom camera here. How did that become the true version, the authorized?
I'm not sure I can answer that yet. And I'm also curious about when. So because I was bored a couple of weeks ago, I began doing word searches on the Making of America website. That searches over 3,000 newspapers. You can search by date. And I think from maybe 1820 to 1900, there might have been, I don't know, 10 hits or so, not very many. And I expanded to 1960. I had somewhere over 30 hits, a concentration of them in 1920, which is when some people would have been remembering it as the centennial. May not be 1820. Some sources suggest 1824, 1823. There's various thoughts about that. But I was kind of stunned that it didn't make it into the newspapers more often. We're talking about Joseph and the Church, which either suggests that my methodology is really flawed, which might well be the case, or it became really significant to the churches in more recent years. And my guess is that part of what made it so significant is for our tradition and maybe the LDS Church as well, we begin publishing things like Joseph Smith Tells His Own Story, little standalone tracts. And of course, in the Church of Jesus Christ, it was canonized as part of the Pearl of Great Price as well. So slowly grows in importance, I think, in both churches to the point where we anyway, and I think the Mormons as well, were converting people on Joseph's conversion experience. And we often get confused and think that it was the foundational event for the church. It was not. It was Joseph's conversion experience. We would convert others based on that. And then anti-Mormons would come along and pull out different versions, might only be one personage. And it could be devastating, as we have seen with folks that we interact with. And so in Community Christ, we realized that it was really not helpful to convert people on that 1838 account. We stepped back, again, have gone to the 1832 account. But even a more recent development, John Charles Duffy, who teaches for us in Bauvoo in the summer months with our history interns, kind of had a really interesting insight. So a new interpretation of an experience with the divine. Now, I would always say in the past, it's because there's all these multiple accounts and, you know, on and on. Well, John Charles looked at it and said, well, we just want to provide room for all of the understandings related to the first vision. We want to make it comfortable for people. And I really like that take.
Well, that's a perspective of hospitality to be offered.
Yeah, it is. Probably not in the mind. Well, maybe in the minds of the people who made the first video, I don't know. But it's not the way I had seen it in recent years. And I really kind of appreciated that perspective. I think another challenge that we had related to kind of the Joseph Smith version of the story, we would, as the church began to expand internationally, we were going into non-Christian nations with the Joseph Smith one true Christian church. You know, here's the experience that confirms that. When these people didn't know what Christians were, and it really caused us, I believe, to kind of step back and reevaluate what was the core of the gospel story, what's the heart of the message that we're going to share. And I think that was kind of part of the reinterpretation as well.
So as we began to reinterpret it, step back, as you say, and look at what is the message that we want to share, how did that affect kind of the identity and mission of the church? If we were focused on that story and that conversion experience as our story, then as we step back and reframed, how did that affect the church as a whole?
So I think that the impact on the church was to make our foundations more Jesus-based and less Joseph-based. Not that, of course, Jesus isn't in the vision, but I really do think that was kind of a pretty significant shift that was occurring in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, as we kind of pivoted. Joseph's still in the story, but Jesus is the foundation, is the heart of the story.
What we would now call Christ-centered story. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's helpful to kind of get our heads wrapped around that shift. For us, it also explains why some of our longtime heritage members have a harder time letting go of some of that first vision language and how they understand the church and their relationship to the church. So when we look at the first vision, this happened in a period of time in the United States that was our frontier time, if you will. It happened on the frontier when the frontier was still on the eastern half of the United States. So what are some contextual points about that time that help inform us as we look at how the telling of this story evolved and grew and began to take shape in the life of the church?
I think there's a number of points to remember, but among them, Joseph is in what was later known as the burned over district, that part of New York that was burned by the religious fervor, the Holy Spirit of these revivals. And he was not alone in having a theophany. So these kind of visionary experiences are happening to other people. They're recording them. Rick Grunder, a friend who put together Mormon Parallels, a bibliographic source, was kind enough to share maybe the most strikingly similar one. I think Richard Bushman had lifted it up years ago as well. A guy named Norris Stearns, who published an account of his visionary experience in 1815. I'll share an abridged version. Still a little long, but I think it's worth it. So Norris Stearns, "I was in great despair and could not pray. And if I attempted to plead for mercy, sin for a while clouded all hope. As I lay, suddenly there came a sweet flow of the love of God to my soul, which gradually increased. At the same time, there appeared a small gleam of light in the room above the brightness of the sun, which grew brighter and brighter. As this light and love increased, my sins began to separate. At length, being in an ecstasy of joy, whether in the body or out, I cannot tell, God knoweth, I saw two spirits, which I knew at the first sight. But if I had the tongue of an angel, I could not describe their glory, for they brought the joys of heaven with them. One was God, my maker, almost in bodily shape like a man. His face was, as it were, a flame of fire, and his body as it had been a pillar and a cloud. Below him stood Jesus Christ, my Redeemer, in perfect shape like a man. His face was not ablaze, but had the countenance of fire, being bright and shining. His Father's will appeared to be his. All was condescension, peace, and love. I was filled with the sacred flame and the glory of God. It was a heaven here below for the space of half an hour. A wonderful account of his experience. Again, lots of similar language in it as well.
So that might be a little disconcerting to some people to hear that there were other experiences that were that similar, although it did stick to the two personages, so they can, you know, hang on to that at least. So when I was learning, growing up and learning about this story, one of the things that happened, and I recognize it now as an adult looking back, is that I learned the story of the church outside of the context of what was happening in United States history. And so I had told you earlier that when I first read The Democratization of American Christianity, which is the worst title of a book ever, by Nathan O. Hatch, and he talked about other religious leaders than Joseph Smith having a Grove experience as the founding experience of the church, that my head just exploded with this kind of, well, of course, because they're on the frontier and there's 27 people living in a 10-foot cabin. And if I want to pray somewhere where there's peace and quiet, I am heading to the woods. That only makes sense. And that just changed my entire way of looking at the early history of the church. I can no longer look at what happened and take it out of context and rub it and cherish it and make it all shiny and pure and clean. It has to be looked at in the muck and the mire of our difficult and confusing United States history. That changes things for people.
Context changes things.
So what are some other kinds of contextual pieces that help us understand this part of our story?
So there's a couple things that I think are really important to remember as we're talking about the first vision. One is that if you talked about the vision in the early 1830s in the church, it was section 76 of the Doctrine and Covenants. That's what people knew of as the vision. And it was highly controversial because it was universalist. All are saved. With just a small asterisk for the sons of perdition. So people recognized universalism in that experience, and they were uncomfortable with it in some cases. So church members knew little or nothing about what we call the first vision. This was, again, Joseph's personal conversion experience. It was not widely discussed. The miracle of the church was the Book of Mormon, not this visionary experience. There are some accounts, again, written down and eventually published before Joseph's death. But it was not the big deal that it would later become.
Well, now we're going to have to go back and do an episode on universalism to find out why by the 1830s, universalism was a dirty word when, in fact, most of the founding fathers of the United States were universalists, and it was a common way to understand God and does God continue to interact in the world. So you're going to be returning, I see, for another episode going forward.
We'll need another guest to help me, though.
Well, if you're out there, guest, let us know, and we'll do our best to discuss this, because now I find that really interesting, especially when we have as an enduring principle, all are called, worth of all person, blessings of community.
Yep.
That'll make a wonderful topic. Okay, so.
Can I throw out another point of context?
Please do.
So, you know, as we've touched on, Joseph's earliest account and the early accounts talk about one personage. Eventually, he transitions to two. I believe that simply expresses Joseph's evolving understanding of the nature of God. But also by the 1838 account, which is the one that most people know so well, it has pretty rough language talking about other Christians. You know, all are an abomination, denouncing creeds. It's pretty rough. Richard Bennett, formerly BYU, was kind enough to point out to me, though, that language comes at a time when we were in conflict in northern Missouri and soon would be exterminated or expelled from the state by these people who claimed to be Christian. So it only makes sense, I believe, that we would not hold, quote, Christians in high regard as they were committing atrocities against us. And at times we were returning the favor. So that 1838 account, I think, is best understood in the context of the 1838 Mormon War.
Helpful to remember. While we're talking about the version that most people learned, you commented earlier that depending on when you learned it, what you learned was very different. So what I learned in the 60s, early 60s, was learned on the West Coast, and granted, my parents were converts, and my dad was and is what I would call a zealot for the Restoration. And so I was taught a very succinct story. You said in Jackson County, Missouri, in the 70s and 80s, it was very different. What did you learn?
So I just don't remember a lot from my childhood. But I knew that Joseph had an experience, but as far as the specifics, two personages, one personage, I didn't know. Now, I think part of that is not so much Jackson County, but simply the kind of home I was raised in. My dad's Australian. There's kind of an international flavor in the house. And I don't know why that would make a difference, but I think it did. And I'm not really sure why.
So we put it back into context, and we understand that Joseph's theology developed as he went along, which helps us understand the differences in some of the versions. But there's also the simple reality that as I retell a story from my life, it changes as I age because I look back on that story differently. But also it changes based on my audience. Does that get reflected in the differences in some of the versions?
I think probably it gets reflected in some of the versions, but I need to keep spending some time thinking that through. I've always defaulted to, you know, Joseph starts basically Trinitarian or modalist, and eventually by Nauvoo understands, you know, three separate distinct beings, God with a physical body. So I have just assumed that his variations in the telling of the story simply reflect his evolving understanding of the nature of God. And I don't think anybody in the early church, Joseph included, said, I know that God the Father and Jesus Christ the Son are separate distinct beings because I saw them both in vision. I think that's a later development to try and separate them that way. And I don't know, have you ever heard that from a Community of Christ member? In our LDS perspective, is that an LDS thing?
Rephrase the question for me. Have I heard what?
To use the 1838 First Vision account to confirm some understanding of the nature of God.
Yes, I have heard that. I heard it recently. I had made an offhanded comment to my mother when she was talking about God, and she was using male language for God. And I made a comment that God does not have gender, Mom. And my dad piped up with, oh, yes, God does. And that vision of God the Father and Jesus the Son was lived out to correct my error. And as my mom has said, who doesn't listen to Project Zion, does the church know you say these things?
They do now.
They do. Mom, thank you. I am your tithing dollars at work. So we have to, I mean, again, I learned the church story from my parents who learned it when they were converted in the mid-1950s. Yeah, I have heard that expressed that way. And I would venture to say that there are a lot of heritage members around my parents' age who would see it that same way.
Yep.
Yeah, very much so. So what does all this have to say to us today? Where does this live in Community of Christ today?
So let me answer that by telling you a story. We have had in the past a program called the World Service Corps, where we send people from North America to other parts of the world to be engaged in the life of the church. And we bring international members to the States, sometimes to help at the Independence Temple, and often to help at Kirtland and Nauvoo. So they are learning the story, learning the history, but also developing their language skills, their English skills. Years ago, Rosemary and Esther, who were African grandmothers, were participants in that program. And Andrew Bolton and I took them to Palmyra for a visit. They were in Kirtland, it was maybe four and a half hours. And I got to say that I almost believed the conventional wisdom at the time, which was that our mostly white male North American 19th century story would not speak to international members. It simply would not be relevant to them. My experience was exactly the opposite, because so many of our international members are living the story today of poverty and persecution and 8-hour long worship services. They connected much faster than our North American members do today. But I was a little nervous as we entered the grove. It was raining. I had this picture in my mind of those brilliantly colored dresses they were wearing. They were wearing dresses from their home nations, and these umbrellas up, and all that set against the just stunning green backdrop of the wet leaves, and just kind of wandering through the grove together quietly. I don't think we spent much time talking. I think maybe somebody offered a prayer or two in there, but as we started to exit the grove, I don't remember if it was still in the trees or in the car afterwards, we started talking about what this might mean to them. Was it relevant in any way? And one of the two made a comment. It was kind of painful, because she said that she doubted her worth in the eyes of God at times. But what she had learned that day was that if God cares for a poor, illiterate farm boy, maybe there's room for God to care about a poor African grandmother. Again, it kind of hurt that she doubted her worth, but I also was thrilled that she recognized her worth. So here's why I think the first vision is meaningful to contemporary members of Community of Christ. Drawing on two of our enduring principles, all are of worth in the eyes of God, and by extension, all are called. A poor farm boy, an African grandmother, a fisherman or woman in French Polynesia, all are of worth and all are called. That is the message of the first vision today.
I want to thank you, Locke, for sharing that with us, especially that meaningful story from the grove. In the spirit of what we've learned about these versions of Joseph Smith's vision, which was his conversion story, the moment when he could identify his encounter with God and what it means to the church with our enduring principles. I feel compelled to ask this question in maybe a little different way. And that is, you live and breathe and swim, if you will, in this language and in this historical narrative. But what has it meant to you?
So that's a pretty personal question.
Yeah.
So it probably helped me frame some experiences in my life. So I have a very, I think some people are created to see the world through spiritual eyes, and some people through natural eyes or science, the lens of science, and I'm the latter. So, for example, when I was an adolescent, I don't know, 12, 13, 14, for a period of months, I had these amazing experiences in that space between asleep and awake in the morning, when I was just overwhelmed by this brilliant white light, incredible warmth. It just felt so wonderfully good. And I believe that it was some kind of biological process. But if I saw the world differently, for months, I would have been having these amazing experiences that would have been communing with the Lord. That's just not my lens. But I still think that it framed an experience that I had at Kirtland Temple for the first time. So, you know, I was raised in the church, and I've told this story many times, but raised in the church, but it never really took. And then it was the history that captured me or grabbed me and pulled me into the life of the church. As I was entering the first floor of the Kirtland Temple for the first time, though, I was almost knocked over by the power of the Holy Spirit. And I knew that at that moment that there was more to this story than just great history or great architecture or even interesting science. That there was more to this story that I wanted to spend significant time and now have devoted my life to exploring and sharing. But I also have to think about how I have told that story through the years and how when it happened, I don't know that I understood it as my first vision experience, my conversion experience. But it has definitely become that, and it's real. At the time, I think it was just a powerful presence of the Holy Spirit that I really recognized for the first time in my life. So I'm intrigued. Is my framing of that wonderful experience into my personal conversion experience, is that deceitful or unethical or in some way wrong? I don't think so. I mean, it's real to me. And I make room for Joseph to have done the same. I think it was real. You know, I think, does the historicity of the first vision matter? Well, I think it matters that Joseph had some kind of experience to me. What are the details? I don't know. I'm not going to get stuck on that. It doesn't matter to me.
Well, thank you, Locke, for sharing that personal glimpse into...
Yeah, hopefully you'll edit that out.
into what that has meant to you. And thank you again for being with us as part of Cup of Joe. And we are part of the greater Project Zion podcast family. Are there any last comments or last thoughts you want to share with our listeners before we go?
I'm done.
All right. Well, with that, we will conclude our conversation on the first vision. We have enjoyed the conversation a great deal. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.